Ladies and gentlemen, we are back with David Andress, Professor of Modern History at the University of Portsmouth, for part two of the fantastic conversation about the French Revolution. Professor, like a pair of seasoned screenwriters, we concluded the last episode with a massive cliffhanger. Now, the events described during the first part were, dare I say, given the widespread injustice and hardship that we talked about at the time, pretty inspiring. This is going to be, of course, a gross oversimplification of but you described how the representatives of the Third Estate, made up of mostly educated citizens but representing all commoners, began sort of taking and grabbing power from the other two, the aristocracy and the clergy. Then things began spiraling, and eventually the city of Paris rose up and the king surrendered to them. So far, so good. However, towards the end of our chat, you hinted at some pretty dark clouds gathering on the horizon. Two important developments that you mentioned were, number one, the formation and proliferation of the Jacobin clubs. So revolutionaries who perceived themselves as the only good patriots, but throughout the years began kind of sliding into a bit of a frenzy, seeing more and more counter-revolutionaries everywhere. And number two, externally, you said that at the beginning of the revolution, other powers, other monarchies were having a bit of a laugh at France's expense, but quite quickly, all that sneering turned into saber-rattling, especially once Louis XVI was executed. You provided a delicious quote by Edmund Burke, who at the time said, I have to read it out, "The swinish multitudes have destroyed a flourishing hierarchical society." I have to start using this in my daily life. Anyway, let's maybe continue here with the revolution's ultimate break with the old regime, the downfall of the French king, this unfortunate lad who just wouldn't take a mistress. How does he get into such a pickle?
Well, I mean, that's going to be quite a long story. I mean, one of the things that, again, we need to remember about the French Revolution as a historical episode is that, I mean, on the one hand, it evolves very rapidly, and on the other hand, it evolves over several years.
Right.
So the sort of political positions and reflections that people are having by 1792 are almost completely unimaginable 3 or 4 years earlier. And it's because of the way that politics has evolved over those years that you end up with that situation. I think one of the key ways of thinking about what happens in general between 1789 and 1792, 93 is to see that different dimensions of, as it were, misunderstanding or incomprehension or ideological conflict. You've got, from the very beginning, a very straightforward conflict between people who see themselves as the revolutionaries and people that they see as the counter-revolution. That, I mean, as we talked about last time, the storming of the Bastille happens because there is a counter-revolutionary coup attempted, and the Bastille is stormed to defend against it. So counter-revolution is always real. You know, one of the king's brothers is already outside France after July 1789, and that brother, the Comte de Provence, is constantly agitating to destroy the revolution, agitating that his brother, the king, is effectively a prisoner, needs to be rescued, and so on and so forth. And a lot of people within the social elite inside France are essentially sympathetic to that view. So there is always a counter-revolution, and there is always the patriotic view that this must be fought against, that the French have gained their liberty, and that is something to be defended. One of the paradoxes that you'll see throughout is that even a lot of the most radical sentiments that evolve over the following years are essentially defensive. They're essentially pinned on to the idea that something foundational was achieved in 1789. And it's defending that really matters. What that means in practice, what that means in terms of constructing a future they're much less clear about, but they're very clear on that threat to those foundations. And the other dimension, the sort of up down on the map that we might draw as opposed to the left right, is that what's actually being built from the summer of 1789 onwards is a really quite authoritarian, top-down, centralized state. That, you know, we would like to think of the French Revolution as being essentially libertarian. You know, it's liberty, equality, fraternity. This is what it's supposed to be about. But when we explore what that means in practice, it means that the revolutionaries in the National Assembly, the ones who are writing the Constitution, are imagining their country, their fellow citizens, as people who need to be governed, people who need to be controlled. And there's all sorts of levels at which this is perceptible. One of the key things that will disturb the revolution throughout these years is a really hostile attitude from the political elite to the rural population, to the peasantry, who are the majority, who've made this sort of spectacular revolution in both words and actions in 1789, throwing off the yoke of feudalism. And right through into 1793, the political elite will keep trying to impose new burdens of taxation on them, will keep trying to get them to carry on paying their feudal dues, because that money is an investment. Those are middle class savings that they're trying to do away with. And there's a complete lack of comprehension from the centre to the periphery about what life is actually like, and how grateful people should be for their liberation, which often doesn't feel like a liberation if you're being ordered to carry on paying money to your feudal lord, because that's now become, as if by magic, a capitalist debt. So there's all sorts of things like that going on. And the constitution that's actually being constructed, although it uses elections to fill offices, to have village mayors and district councillors and all sorts of public officials, it uses elections, but it understands voting and serving in these positions as essentially obligations of citizenship rather than rights and entitlements. As the revolutionaries write this new constitution, they're writing a vision of citizens taking part in voting, not to express political opinions, not to have views, but just to pick the best people to do these essentially administrative things. And when they write down, you know, what is it that a village mayor should be doing? What is it that a district council should be doing? They write down a list of things which are basically about controlling the population and making it obedient to the diktats coming down from the centre. A constant stream of administrative requirements starts to flow down from Paris to every village in late 1789. And it never really stops. And if we look ahead past the fall of the monarchy into the years of the terror, 1793, 1794, village councils are receiving, in some cases, dozens of decrees every week, straight from the centre, printed documents telling them to do things. And this is the whole vision of a constitutional nation that actually comes out in these years, 1789, 1991. It's very rigid. It's very controlling. And the idea of patriotism, the idea of being good citizens, is one of the things that's used to ram that message home against the threat of counter-revolution. And it's, you know, a deep irony that, you know, what prevents this essentially authoritarian and monarchical vision embedding itself is not resistance from below, but the threat of the counter-revolution. You know, that it's all this stuff goes much too far for the counter-revolutionaries. It's much too egalitarian, even though it's also authoritarian. And so it is the threat of aristocratic resistance both sort of secular resistance from the nobility, and also interestingly religious resistance, which is something else we might get on to talk about, is this material and cultural threat to what underpins the revolution, which actually pushes further conflict into the future.
You mentioned counter-revolution. Was it a legitimate threat throughout these events, or was it also a little bit of a mouse conveniently blown up into an elephant in order to mop up whoever was becoming a thorn in the side of the revolutionaries?
Well, I think it is a very serious threat, because it has to be understood in the framework of the revolutionaries feeling everything they're doing to be essentially fragile. That they have pinned their hopes after July and August 1789 on being able to design a constitutional monarchy, because not having a monarchy is almost literally unthinkable. It would bring instant civil war. It would bring instant foreign invasion. It's just unthinkable. The country needs a monarchical governmental structure. And having committed to that, they're then committed to that being Louis XVI. I mean, there are conspiracy theorists around who think that the radicals really want to get rid of Louis and replace him with the Duke of Orléans. But that is a counter-revolutionary conspiracy theory, essentially. The problem then is if you have Louis, then you have his whole family. you have to acknowledge that his brothers, one of whom is in exile as a counter-revolutionary, are also members of this royal family. You have to acknowledge that the Queen is also there, that there will be a royal court, there will be some kind of vaguely aristocratic structure around it. You've lumbered yourself with having to deal with all the appurtenances of monarchy and design a constitution around it, which is different from the old way of doing things. And so the fear always persists that it would only take a little bit of resistance from the king and from people around him to make this fall apart. And they have that fear as early as the autumn of 1789. There's tremendous upheaval during September, with a very extended debate about whether the king should be able to veto legislation. And they end up giving in this compromise thing called a suspensive veto, which means they have to pass laws three times over 6 years to override his veto. But that segues then into a panic at the beginning of October about actual sort of counter-revolutionary troops at Versailles, and a panic about the food supply, which leads to the very famous March on Versailles by the women of Paris, led by the market women, and thousands of women and men, the revolutionary militia, the National Guard, march from Paris to Versailles and basically force the revolutionary leadership to persuade the king to move from Versailles back to Paris. The idea that this will force his hand politically, and it will also improve the food supply, that the king is a sort of totem, a guarantee that Paris can't be starved. Because he's there, there is a suspicion that, hunger in Paris, high food prices, these are always suspected to be a conspiracy, a plot. And so it goes. So already you've had huge change forced on the revolutionary landscape in late 89 by fear about what's happening around the king, by popular initiative, by the sort of the demonstrating power of the crowd. And Louis does move to the Tuileries Palace, and the National Assembly moves after him and sets itself up so that politics moves from Versailles to Paris emphatically. But then they carry on trying to build the constitution. But it's only a couple of months later when there is another counter-revolutionary conspiracy, which seems to be an actual plot by a chap called the Marquis de Favras to rescue the king and queen, to smuggle them out of the city to safety, where they can help overthrow the revolution. And this is not a very serious plot, and Favras is detained and tried and executed for it, but it implicates the king's brother in support for it. So these things are going on all the time. And you then you have then the whole next 12 to 14 months through to early 1791, where the king is just there in Paris, nodding along, signing decrees. Everyone's hoping that he turns out to be the keystone of the Constitution. But all at the same time, lots of other things are happening which call that into question. And this is where perhaps we need to segue to the religious dimension, because
let's
this
do
is
it.
Again, yes, fascinatingly important.
Okay.
The sort of enlightened mentality of most of the revolutionary leadership sees religion as a social function, basically. It keeps the plebs in their place. It provides basic education. It provides basic healthcare. It provides
opium
charity
for the masses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is a classic Enlightenment position. Marx's point, of course, is that the masses need opium because they're suffering. But that's another dimension to it. So there's a sense that the Catholic Church in particular is a national institution of the country. It was the first estate of the kingdom. But so now it has to have some kind of collective characteristic. But what they will end up doing late in 1789 is deciding that the Catholic Church, which is extremely wealthy, give or take a tenth of all the land in the country, loads of investments, loads of urban buildings and property, portfolios and so on.
Portfolios, not a word I was expecting in relation to the Catholic Church in the 18th century.
But it is. It's an extremely wealthy organization.
Hedge fund, yeah.
And the financial marketplace shenanigans are a whole other way. Just in terms of material property, it's an extremely wealthy organization.
Reminds me of The Godfather Part 3. Sorry, yeah, go on.
But all this is now at the disposal of the nation, according to the National Assembly. And that property portfolio is what they intend to use to deal with the national debt, which, if you remember, going right back to this is why there is a revolution in the first place,
right?
Because
they couldn't get out of it. Yeah,
national debts. So that material debt crisis is always there in the background, and the revolutionaries decide they're going to basically nationalize the property of the church, turn the clergy into salaried state employees, and then take that property, issue bonds which are called assignats on the overall value of that property, use those bonds to pay the state's creditors, and then they can use them to buy the land of the church. And so the state's debts gets liquidated into a transfer of property from the church to individuals. And this has several dimensions of trouble. The first is theological, that they will end up deciding that if the clergy are salaried state employees, then they should be elected the same way as all these other state employees and public officials are elected. So they put the appointment of parish priests and bishops inside this essentially secular structure of public election, which would involve people who are not even Catholic being able to vote on these things, and hence violating the very obvious rules of apostolic succession, particularly for bishops. And this is sort of theologically implausible from the point of view of many Catholics. And it's also implausible for all kinds of other reasons when they start reorganizing the church, because now they want to rationalize its structures. There are far too many bishops in France. They can get rid of a third of them at least. Geographical rationalization is another thing they're pursuing relentlessly through this period. So you'll end up with a situation where the clergy as a whole find themselves at odds with this process. And many of the clergy start to see this as the essential evil of the whole revolution. More conservative-minded clergy start to talk about the satanic inspiration of all of this, and their resistance spreads to their population, to their flocks, to their
So they're preaching about it every
Sunday. They're preaching about it. They're preaching back to their own church. They are forming networks about this. And by the end of 1790, this is such a problem for the National Assembly because the clergy are a vital connection between centre and periphery. They you know, the church and weekly services are a part of civic life as well as religious life in the village. It's where people find things out. You know, the clergy read them letters and things. This is their long-term role, which is only partly replaced by secular.
Quick question. Were most of the peasants literate at that time or no?
Not most.
I
mean, it's not a sort of society which is mired in mass illiteracy. But certainly there are regions where you'd say that the majority of peasants in any particular village probably can't read.
So,
some can, but some can't.
Right. It's
not one or the other.
So in this case, they were dependent on priests to relay information from the center to them.
From the center. I mean, this is one of their roles under the old monarchy, is to do this.
Right.
And it's only been partly replaced by mayors and councils and so on. But by the end of 1790, the National Assembly decided they need to shore up this whole system. They need to shore up the system of the assignat, which is their currency now. They're issuing paper money, basically, to pay for their everyday needs. People are using it as money. And the value of that depends on all these transactions with the church going well. So they decide that the clergy have to take a loyalty oath at the end of 1790 and into 1791. And what will happen then is that half of the clergy will not take that oath, will refuse it. Several tens of thousands of people across the country, in areas of the West and the South, 3/4 or more of the clergy in those areas refuse to take this oath. And so there is immediately established a body that, you know, one can refer to as the refractory clergy. There is now a group within society who have refused this oath and often stating very loudly and publicly why they're refusing it. They don't believe in the revolution. They think it's an attack on the natural order of things, so on and so forth. And many of them taking their own parishioners into resistance with them. So that in the northwest of France, for example, by the end of 1790, there's quite serious violence opposing urban authorities to rural crowds over this issue of who controls the church. And it's also wrapped up with other things like very aggressive tax collecting and a general urban sense that the peasants are scum, and that having them at the end of a musket is the best place to keep them. Then real kinds of nasty, gritty tensions in society there. But they are playing out then at this level, which makes this about revolution versus counter-revolution.
What's the Pope saying about all this?
Oh, the Pope is very unhappy.
I can imagine.
The king, the royal family, want papal advice before they decide whether they're signing on to all this business. And there is a whole episode in early 1791 where the king's maiden aunts try to go on a pilgrimage to Rome to ask the Pope what he thinks and are not allowed to leave the country. When the Pope does opine in writing around about Easter 1791, he again is against this, naturally, because it's a flagrant violation of the apostolic succession of bishops and a flagrant violation of the institutional independence of the church. Of course he's against it. He's also against it because, like a lot of people, he's starting to think it might actually be the work of Satan. You know, that religious theological sense that what the revolutionaries are doing is so extreme, so crazy, that it has to be about a kind of devilish inspiration rises over the years ahead. But what all this means, coming back to the main question, is that Louis XVI is put in an impossible position.
Again. Poor lad.
Poor chap. He's really bad at coping with these impossible positions. But by early 1791, and we know this from the correspondence, particularly of the Queen, the King and the Queen are plotting the overthrow of the revolution. They are plotting the overthrow of the revolution through means of an escape from Paris, to flee towards the eastern frontier, to meet up with the loyal senior leadership of the army. That they also believe, and they're very wrong about this, that the rural population in general will be on their side. But from about February 1791 through to June, they are actively plotting this escape. And then on the night of the 20th, 21st of June, they actually carry out this escape. They flee the city in a carriage, which turns out to be much too slow. And they end up being stopped at a place called Varennes on the road to the eastern frontier, where they're, you know, they're physically confronted with the fact that these urban townspeople, provincial townspeople, will not let them through, despite the fact that the king, you know, throws off his disguise and is revealed to be the king. And they're all very respectful of him as the king. I see.
So they're wearing disguises in the hope that nobody would recognize them. But people recognize them?
The disguise is basically, you know, false papers.
A mustache.
Well, one of the legends about it is the idea that the king gets recognized because his picture is on the assignat. The paper the money notes. Has a picture of the king on it. So they are circulating through everyone's hands. But he's been written down on this passport as one of the servants of a lady who is traveling here.
The king has a passport.
The disguise falls away.
Like a fake passport.
No, not a passport as we'd imagine it now. Yeah. But I mean, to travel around in France in general, one needed passports in a generic sense,
ID,
which would be documents of some kind.
I see.
From an authoritative figure. And in this case, it's the one of their servants has taken on the role of, I think, a Russian noblewoman, and then the rest of the royal family are written down in this passport document as her companions and servants to sort of throw everyone off the scent. But obviously, that has to be abandoned once the king is physically recognized, and then there is this agonizing process whereby he and the royal family are prevented from leaving by larger and larger groups of people mobilized in from the countryside to this small town at the threat of the king leaving. That this is understood immediately as a threat,
as a betrayal,
to the revolution, as a threat to their safety. It cannot be allowed to happen. And the really interesting political dimension to this is obviously back in Paris, there's been hideous panic and recrimination and everyone blaming everyone else for what happens. But the leadership of the revolution at that point in time, who we could broadly refer to as moderate Jacobins, in this sense that they're desperately trying to make this centralized constitutional monarchy work. In order to deal with the fact that the king has left, they are forced to declare that he's been kidnapped. Because if he hasn't been kidnapped, if he's left of his own free will, they can't make him come back. They can't hunt him down. He's the king.
Why not?
So they have to. Well, because he's the king.
But
he's sovereign.
But he's provincial urbanites physically stopped the king from leaving.
Yeah.
Even though he was, I'm the king. They were like, You're not leaving.
Yeah, but they said, you know, it's in those immediate terms out in Varennes, you know, this is an emergency. This is a confrontation.
Right.
Something strange is happening here. Nobody's going anywhere until we get word from higher authority.
We want
to know what the National Assembly thinks.
I see.
You know, in that it's not, it's not you're the king and we're locking you up. It's you're the king, but we need to know what's going on.
Okay. Wow.
Whereas in Paris, they declare that what's going on is that the king has been kidnapped. Because if he's been kidnapped, you can rescue him. If he's left of his own free will, then you'd be the one kidnapping him to bring him back. And they need him to have been kidnapped so that they can rescue him, so that they can figure out a way not to dethrone him. Because again, just as in 1789, there is the perception that if you dethrone him, there will be civil war and external war instantly. So you can't afford to do that. And they send out several members of the National Assembly deputies to meet the king at Varennes, or they meet him just outside Varennes and start traveling back. And while they're in the coach together traveling back, one of them, Barnave, and Queen Marie Antoinette strike up a friendly / manipulative relationship, which leads to a series of secret negotiations through the rest of the summer to get the king to apparently accept the constitution, which is now nearly finished, which again, they've been working on this thing for 2 years. They desperately need it to be finished. So you will have this situation where the king, in leaving, has left behind a manifesto which says, I reject everything. I made a speech on the 23rd of June, 1789, which said, these are my terms. This is what I'm prepared to tolerate in terms of reform. I have never changed my mind about that. All this religious stuff is terrible. All these other changes they're doing are terrible. The formal abolition of nobility in 1790 is terrible. I disagree with it all. I want to reverse it all. They now have to pretend that document doesn't exist. And the king, for the safety of his wife and children, is persuaded to agree that he will go on being king, that he will accept the constitution. And that's what happens in September and October 1791. There are new elections, there's a new legislative assembly, and the constitution starts functioning. But it is obviously doomed to fail. It is based, it is a throne of lies in contemporary terms. You know, the king doesn't believe in what he's doing. The queen is actively plotting with foreign crowns for counter-revolution. The revolutionaries don't believe in the king's goodwill. They just don't know quite what else to do. And the more radical Jacobins in the summer of 1791 had started to demand a referendum on whether they needed a king at all. But the moderate Jacobins repress that violently, which is another dimension of conflict that's happening. So the country is going to become a constitutional monarchy in late 1791. And within weeks, the king is going to be forced to use that veto that they gave him, because the radical Jacobins in the new Legislative Assembly push forward legislation to punish the émigré, to punish the refractory clergy, and the king feels he has no choice but to veto it.
Block it, yeah.
So within 6 weeks or so of the new constitution starting to work, it's already collided with what the king wants. And for the next 6 months, the pressure is going to be for there to be actual war. The radical leadership in the Legislative Assembly, people we call Brissotins, because they're associated with the journalist Jacques-Pierre Brissot, are declaring that the only way to sort this out is to cleanse the frontiers of the emigrated aristocrats. There are by now thousands of nobles, many of whom are military officers, camped outside the frontiers, particularly in the Rhineland, supported by local rulers, supported implicitly by the Austrian Holy Roman Emperor. And the agitation now is for there to be a war to sort this out, or at least to use the threat of war to force the dispersal of the émigré, to remove their military threat.
A war with whom exactly?
The Holy Roman Empire being what it is, there are very many local princedoms and so on. So, you know, one of the things is simply to threaten military action against some of these smaller territories where the émigré are actually living. But the idea, you know, that idea expands until, you know, what they will end up doing in April is declaring war on Austria, which is interesting because it creates a northern theatre of war, because modern day Belgium is Austrian territory at this point. It creates an eastern theatre of war because they're invading that allied territory along the Rhine to try and disperse the actual émigré. And it creates a more general sense that they've gone to war against one of Europe's other great powers, which necessarily then involves all the other great powers in thinking about what they're going to do. So that's part of an escalatory process that started. The other interesting thing about the process that brings about war is that, yeah, after 3 years of revolutionary upheaval, there's an astonishing range of opinion in France who do come around to the idea that war is going to sort something out for them, that they've tried to sort out their internal and politics amongst themselves, but somehow they can't seem to do this without a resort to force on a wider scale. And the craziest vision of this is with Louis and Marie Antoinette themselves, who think that what should happen is that a war should be allowed to start, and then France should lose it, and then in losing the war, they will regain power. But you also have what we might call sensible centrists, people around the Marquis de Lafayette, for example, who's been a very prominent figure in the early years of the revolution, people who are actually involved in governmental ministries now, people saying that, you know, war would bring social discipline back. It would allow them to control these mad radicals. Paris is now seen as being full of mad radicals, always agitating for crazy.
What sort of like a military dictatorship? Or just more generally? Effectively,
wartime conditions would impose social discipline.
Order. Right.
Yeah, there would be the smack of firm government, and we might even be able to put some of these people in the army and get them shot. And a general sense of social discipline could be created by war, you know. And then there are the radicals themselves who are looking for further liberation through war, you know. Even some of them, not just about sort of preserving the situation in France, but some of them even talk about exporting French values now. There was an unsuccessful kind of brother revolution in the Austrian Netherlands in late 1790. So you now have a lot of sort of Belgian refugees in France agitating, saying, you know, help us, let us go back and liberate our countrymen, let us become like you. There is a kind of expansionist edge to some of this thinking as well. So all sorts of different forces within France are saying, you know, war is going to get us what we want. Yeah. And again, interestingly, one of the people who stands out against this most strongly is Maximilien Robespierre, who's going to be the archpriest of terror in the years ahead. But he's someone who's, you know, been a forceful Democrat in the National Assembly, always making an argument for social equality, political equality. And he's now a journalist, and he is writing about the threat of war as itself essentially a conspiratorial danger. That war is a trap. You know, he is intuiting, again, the royal position on this, that powerful people want France to go to war. They intend France to lose that war, and they intend to destroy the revolution.
Not so far off the mark.
He's not far off the mark, but he's very isolated in this view, because most of the other radicals think that, you know, France is undefeatable. You know, because it has been liberated, because its citizenry have been imbued with patriotic power, the fact that a lot of the military officer corps have run away doesn't matter. That war will be victorious. I mean, it's just sort of classic pre-war optimistic
mongering, right?
Going on. So France will then enter wartime conditions from April of 1792. And those wartime conditions then shape everything that happens after that. War is disastrous in the short term. The French troops are not invincible. They are pushed back on the frontiers. Blame for all of this is quite reasonably laid at the door of central government and the monarchy. And over several months of accelerating agitation, the perception that it would be possible to have a republic, to simply depose the king and not just have another king or a regent or something, that rises up in the most radical patriotic circles. In Paris, you have neighborhood councils that are called sections, and they take on a very, very vigorous, militant, patriotic line, because their organization as National Guards, as actual sort of armed battalion of militia, is also part of their identity. So they're both sort of military and militant, always willing to think about an armed solution to these problems. And as the war continues to go badly and political agitation gets higher and higher, by early August, France is now also at war with Prussia. They've joined in the war. And the Austrian and Prussian leadership have explicitly threatened the destruction of Paris, as well as various other things, if the revolutionaries don't surrender to Louis XVI. You know, they've explicitly positioned the war as a war between revolution and counter-revolution, and threatened mass death to the civilian population if they don't give in. You know, so things have got very ideologically crunchy. And in the first week of August, there's a very, very widespread agitation in Paris that the only way forward is an overthrow of the monarchy, which happens on the 10th of August, and is again an intriguingly ambiguous event in its own right, that the king is actually persuaded to surrender himself to the Legislative Assembly with his family before any violence occurs. You know, there is a march of troops towards the palace, thousands of revolutionary mobilized National Guards. There is a military garrison at the palace, particularly the Swiss Guard. Before the two even come into contact, the royal family have surrendered. They have given up. But what they forget to do is to tell the Swiss Guard to stand down. And so there will then be a confrontation between these two military forces in which several hundred people will be killed, essentially by accident, because it doesn't affect the outcome of the day. The king has already surrendered. The Legislative Assembly is already voting to suspend him and to go forward with new elections for a national convention. The violence is incidental to all of that, but of course it becomes emblematic. The notion that those patriotic soldiers had in fact been attacked by the Swiss Guard on the one hand, and on the counter-revolutionary side, the notion that there is then a horrible massacre. That, I mean, you know, there are very vivid accounts of individual Swiss Guards being chased through the streets of Paris and hacked to death and their bodies left in the gutter. Even in the sort of the grassroots archival record of the local police, you find this, that there are just bodies of the Swiss Guard littered around central Paris, and people come in and like they hand in the watches and the handkerchiefs and the snuff boxes they found in these men's pockets. They hand them in to the local police, or they arrest someone for trying to make away with the possessions of this corpse. You know, so it is a very vivid event, but it acquires a legendary status afterwards, that the monarchy was toppled violently. But the monarchy had already toppled itself before the violence. I think this is part of the ambiguity of how all these things are made into story.
Their story is much better, have to say. Yeah.
Yeah. And France is then, you know, by September, it has declared itself to be a republic. At the same time as further horrible massacres have happened in the prisons, that the prisons are seen as the home of what we call in 20th century terms a fifth column of bandits. And imprisoned aristocrats and imprisoned priests. So over 1,000 of them are killed in early September by another wave of patriotic mobilization, following on from news that Verdun has fallen and the enemy troops are advancing on Paris. The military situation and political situation are all entwined. And then the Republic is declared at almost the same moment that the French troops triumph in the Battle of Valmy, pushing those advancing enemy troops into retreat, securing the future. So there's this tremendous moment in late September when the declaration of the Republic and the physical safety of France are brought together at an emblematic moment. And it seems like they're able to make a new start.
All right, we have to conclude Louis' story, though. You said that at the beginning, not having a monarch was unthinkable. How does the unthinkable finally happen in the most brutal way possible, of not just deposing the king, but chopping off his head?
Yeah. Well, this is again the situation that the revolutionary leaderships find themselves in, is constantly working through situations that were previously thought to be unthinkable and having to think their way through to conclusions.
Having their hands forced, or what?
Having their hands forced in all sorts of ways. I mean, the old Legislative Assembly in August, it doesn't depose the king, it suspends him.
Right.
Suspends him from office.
When the Republic is established.
But before the Republic. So in August, he's suspended from office because that's as far as they can imagine going.
Okay.
Then there are new elections, there's a national convention.
So they're always pushing the limits of their imagination. Is that what you're saying?
You push the limits, but you push them slightly. The new national convention, almost the first thing it does is say, yes, France is now a republic. You know, therefore, you know, Louis is no longer king, de facto. So you've moved from a suspension to the creation of a republic within a few weeks. Then they will spend numbers of weeks in September, October, November debating whether they can try Louis.
Right. Whether... Just a second. And there's a fascinating period where he's turned into an ordinary citizen, right? And given a name or something.
Well, effectively. I mean, this again, this follows on from 1790 when they abolished nobility. They abolished their names. So like if you are a noble in France, you are Mr. Something de somewhere. You know, you have that second part of your name, like the Marquis de Lafayette,
right?
For example. De Lafayette is a territorial attribution, which from 1790 onwards, you're not supposed to use. You're supposed to use your family name. His family name is Moutier. He's supposed to be just plain Mr. Moutier now, though in practice, he's too famous for people to actually pay any attention to that. So when you depose the king, he is no longer Louis de Bourbon. He's not identified by the name of the aristocratic house now. So they go all the way back in history to find the last time when the French royal house didn't have that kind of name. And they come up with Capet, which takes you back again, you know, 1,000 years. So they call him Louis Capet because that's his real name.
Monsieur Capet.
Monsieur Capet, yes, exactly. That is his name now. And I mean, again, of course, this is partly just nonsensical grandstanding. Nobody's actually famous by their aristocratic name was ever called anything else. But it's trying to make that point that he's not anything special. But they have in fact spent weeks debating whether or not he's special in any way. That under the Constitution, until the Declaration of the Republic, the king is inviolable. It says so in the Constitution. His actions cannot be challenged. His person cannot be detained. So therefore, that is problematic when you want to put him on trial for things he did while the Constitution was in action, because the Constitution says you can't. And they're all lawyers, and this exercises them tremendously. Ex post facto legislation, you know, doing things that to people for things that weren't illegal when they did them. This is a real, real live issue. And they swing in various directions about this unfortunately, there's nothing we can do on the one hand to other people, like Robespierre, for example, who says the king is outside the terms of normal civil life. He is an outlaw by definition, and therefore we should just execute him. We don't need a legal process. We can just have an executive one. We can just kill him because then he's gone. But that is, again, a very extreme position. So they decide to have a trial and give him defence and all these kind of things. So late December into early January, they rehearse all the things that have happened. This is helped by the discovery in the palace of a secret cupboard, the iron cupboard, in which the king has kept and rigorously documented all the ways he hates the revolution, all the things...
That was real.
Sorry?
That was real. That wasn't...
That was real, yes. I mean, it was a tremendous revelation when it happened. It's very dramatic, exciting news. But yes, authentic documents. This was the king's personal archive of what they intended to change back and all the correspondence that's been going on with other people. Okay. So there's no dispute that he's guilty of the things he's essentially charged with. The question then becomes, what do you do about that? And this is where revolutionary politics, republican politics, is also itself starting to split open. Yeah, these disputes that you had earlier on between moderates and radicals, these are just getting worse and worse. The radicals, the people around Robespierre, they don't think the moderates, the Brissotins that they now call Girondins, they don't think that these people really wanted to overthrow the monarchy. They think they wanted to keep the monarchy because they just got their hands on power. The Brissotins tend to think that Robespierre and his friends wanted to have them killed in September. There's a real sense of their lives were at stake in these processes. And the convention, this body that's been elected that is doing this, it votes unanimously that the king is guilty, But then it will split almost down the middle about what to do with him. Should he be basically sort of held hostage? Should his life be threatened to try and get peace, to try and get a settlement? Should he be sent into exile? Should he be executed now? Should he be sentenced to death and that sentence suspended for blah, 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 blah? Should all of this then go to a referendum? Should there be an appeal to the people about this? And this is frenetic debate about this. And what happens in the end is the immediate death penalty is finally voted for. And if you tot up the votes of different votes in different ways, you can make it look like it was by a one vote majority. But the actual vote was by a majority of about 60 out of 700. So the convention was radically split, but there was a clear majority for
the part of radicals.
Yeah. But all this has revealed just how far apart the two sides of the convention are about what to do. And Louis goes to his death on the 21st of January. There is, again, emblematically, yet another royalist attempt to rescue him on the day itself. The Baron de Batz, who's a famous counter-revolutionary adventurer, tries to stir up the crowd spontaneously to sort of rush the scaffold and rescue him, but gets absolutely nowhere and has to run away.
I love this.
He is executed.
Yeah.
And again, one of the interesting things you can think about this from the point of view of European observers is that they're so cynical, the sort of European diplomats watching this happen, that you find in their correspondence, many of them saying, well, yeah, this is a really stupid thing for the French revolutionaries to have done. It's obviously going to make everything worse for them. Therefore, you know, probably the Austrians were paying for it. You know, they're saying almost in so many words that only the counter-revolution really wanted the king dead. You know, because he's much better for their cause dead than alive. He's a martyr then.
I see.
Alive, he's bloody useless.
Okay.
He's indecisive and stupid, blah, blah, blah. But dead, he's really useful. So in diplomatic circles themselves, you have this conspiracy theory raging that it wasn't the revolutionaries who really wanted him dead, it was someone else. But the revolutionaries are very firm that, in fact, they did want him dead. And they're very glad that he's dead. And it cements the sort of Republican pact that they've got. On the other hand, it's from that point onwards in early 1791 that life for the revolution does start to get really, really difficult. And everything starts to come apart at the seams. Because they find themselves propelled forward into a much wider war. Yeah. Part of their belief system is that everyone is already conspiring against them. So they decide they might as well get everything out in the open. And in February and March 93, they declare war on Britain, on Spain, on the Netherlands, on the Dutch Republic, and on Piedmont, Sardinia, and the Italian states as well. So they've turned what was already a major war into a Europe-wide and indeed global conflict. You know, all the colonies in the Caribbean come into play, the African, you know, slave trade, and all these things now become part of this huge war. And to fight this huge war, they realize they need dramatic, extraordinary means. And this is when the revolution and the republic starts to move towards the terror, because that absolutely top-down authoritarian sense of power that had been there from 1789, had been there in the writing of the original constitution, that the state, the nation, the republic has the right to tell everyone what to do and to demand obedience. This comes flooding out. They will send actual members of the National Convention out as what they call representatives on mission, with plenipotentiary powers to mobilize people for the war effort, to enforce conscription, to enforce obedience, both practically and ideologically. Those representatives will be themselves empowered to give powers to other people locally to do these things. So you set up whole networks of essentially unaccountable power holders whose only recourse is to the people above them who put them in that position. They have no downward loyalty at all. They are trying to impose national conscription, having tried to rely on volunteers to increase the size of the army. They're now demanding 300,000 new soldiers, which is doubling the size of the army. Trying to do that coercively takes us back to the problems they were having with the rural population in general, whether it's about money, whether it's about religion. Disaffected parts of the country rise up against this demand to send their young men off to fight. And in the northwest in particular, in the area around the Lower Loire River, by March of 1793, this has become itself civil war. There is what will call itself the Royal and Catholic Army forms out of the local rural population, becoming what's known to history as the Vendean Revolt. And they will fight a brutal civil war against the forces that the Republic throws at them right the way through 1793 until they're virtually exterminated at the end of that year. And then early 1794, their home villages will be burned to the ground by what are called infernal columns. And, you know, of everyone that dies in the period of the Terror, 90% of them die in the Vendée. There are at least 250,000 people killed, including a very significant number of people on the Republican side. It's a horrifying conflict. And again, its ripples and its echoes shape everything else that's going to happen through the Terror as the Republican leadership fights with itself more and more about why this tremendous mobilization isn't producing a more immediate victory, is causing them to carry on being more and more paranoid about who their real enemies are, who their real friends are. And the story of the Terror will be, on the one hand, this huge practical mobilization for a war effort, which is eventually successful. And on the other hand, this decline into real backstabbing paranoia, which ends up completely consuming itself.
So the Terror was essentially spurred on by this forced mobilization and conscription. I've never heard that before, but I wanted to ask something extremely naive here. I wanted to ask, how bad was the Terror really? Because a lot of the times this period seems sort of instrumentalized from different sides of the political spectrum today. People on the left will say that it was, you know, mainly the fattening, parasitic aristocrats who got the chop, while folks on the right will claim that ordinary citizens were indiscriminately killed left and right, and then also tried to paint the entire revolution as basically being one big slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. Who's closer to the truth here?
No, it's a very complicated situation. I mean, one way of thinking about it in terms of, I mean, the focus on death, for example.
Yeah, and the guillotine.
And the guillotine. I mean, there is a rhetoric of death, there is a rhetoric of the guillotine that seems to wallow in a lot of this. But if you compare it to the American Revolution, which is very much part of the same historical situation, I mean, the population of the American colonies is only about a tenth of the population of France. So it's a very different scale. But in terms of the intensity of violence, the intensity of death and persecution and political exile, relative to those 3 million people in the American colonies, it was as intense as it was to the 28 million people in France. Proportionally, there's not a lot of difference. It's just that in the American case, a lot of it is dispersed across the frontier. A lot of the violence is hard to see until people have really dug into the record of what 8 years of warfare were actually like. And it doesn't have with it this destructive, demonizing rhetoric, which is completely attached to what happens in France. You know, so as I've already said, at the level of numbers of actual deaths in France, you have some really horrific totals. 250,000 people in the Vendée, probably another 30 or 40,000 people executed for armed rebellion elsewhere in the country. Over 2,500 people formally tried and executed by guillotine for what are often completely imaginary political crimes, but at the root of which there is a real ongoing conflict that the political authorities are trying to wrestle with. So the large material situation is, as it were, understandable, and relative to other major civil war type conflicts, not disproportionate. But what does distinguish the French Revolutionary Terror is the way it's incapable of not consuming itself. That the level at which paranoia of counter-revolutionary conspiracy translates to a willingness to very rapidly get rid of former close political allies is particularly distinctive in the period. You know, you don't see that in the American context. That, you know, they have a few of famous traitors, people like Benedict Arnold, but they're not conducting sort of political witch hunts on a weekly basis.
Purges.
You know, and this is what you have in France from the end of 1793, very explicitly using that precise language. I mean, they talk about épuration, which is purification, but it's also purge. It is the vocabulary that came down to us, you know, through the sort of Leninist left, that they've already decided from the summer and autumn of 1793 that their own structures, their own political societies, their own political are riddled with counter-revolution. Because obviously, if they weren't, everything would be going better. I mean, and this is the paranoia. It just works it through. Month after month, they are finding reasons to treat disagreement of one kind about political tactics, military tactics, strategy, to treat disagreement as evidence of latent counter-revolution, and to pursue people for that, and to imprison them, and to put them on trial, so that, you know, by the end of 1793, they've locked up a significant proportion of the officer corps, for example, and they're starting to think that actually the rot goes all the way into the heart of the political class. By the spring of 1794, you have this infamous period where factional disputes by kind of ultra-leftists on the one hand and moderates-ish on the other become an excuse for the leadership between them to destroy both groups. But those groups are dissenting from correct behaviour in different ways, but both ways are objectively counter-revolutionary. And so they are wrapped up in what are fundamentally absurd charges of conspiracy with foreign enemies, literally fabricated conspiracies.
Is there a trial for these people, or do they go straight to the guillotine?
Well, this is the process of trial before what they've now got this revolutionary tribunal. The process of trial is that of articulating these absurd conspiratorial allegations, and then people who've been handpicked to make up the jury agree that it's guillotining time, and off they go. It is brutally absurd, you know. And increasingly, as you go through these years, through these months, really, the first 7 months of 1794, you're looking at a political culture which is living with a threat of death, which is absurd. The things for which you can be arrested, the things for which you can be suspected, are absurd. The degree to which there's no telling from week to week whether you'll get a fair hearing in a public political setting, in the Jacobin Club or in the convention. You might get a fair hearing, you might get an applauded speech, you might get agreement, or you might literally be arrested. You might be taken off in the middle of the night and put
on trial. Were some of the absurd things that you could get arrested for in that time?
Well, I think it's all absurd.
Okay.
It's all hinging on the idea that the things that people did were evidence that they were counter-revolutionary conspirators. And therefore, anything you did could be turned into evidence. You know, even, you know, not agreeing forcefully enough with something stupid that someone else said could be turned into evidence that you were a secret counter-revolutionary. The Parisian authorities come up with a list earlier on, the end of the previous summer, the September 1793. They come up with a list of things which would mark people out as unworthy citizens, to whom they, like, what they call carte de civisme, like sorts of political passports, would not be issued to this list of people. And it's a list of people which includes things like being too pessimistic, yeah, being too worried about how the war was going.
I'm sorry, Professor, but yeah, not, a bit of dark humor there, I have to say.
Not being enthusiastic enough in public assemblies.
I would be a goner.
Yeah, not speaking up, you know, claiming that you had nothing to say. This was itself evidence that you were secretly a counter-revolutionary. You have to stand there and you have to make, you know, what Orwell talks about Soviet communism, these people are half gangster, half gramophone. You're supposed to just churn out the approved slogans at the approved moment at the approved volume, or else. Yeah. But the deeper absurdity of all of this is it's always already breaking down. You know, it's not like Soviet communism. They can't keep it going for decades. It breaks down by June and July 1794.
Just one quick question. Was anybody at the time at the top going like, hey, fellas, I think we're overdoing this a little bit. I think this is getting a little bit absurd. Would this kind of articulation already mark you out for persecution and death?
Well, this is exactly how it ends. I mean, it ends because Maximilian Robespierre in particular, this kind of prophet of purity, has backed himself into a corner by July 1794, where the only way he can be consistent to what he already believes, to what he sees around him, is to start saying that almost literally everyone except him and a tiny circle of true believers are objectively counter-revolutionary. And by late July, he is saying this publicly, that the people and the convention need to get together and somehow purge themselves of what in some lakes looks like the majority of everyone. And other individual political leaders who've seen other factions go to the guillotine, who know that they personally have annoyed Robespierre and his friends, they are able finally to say, you know, look, fellas,
we're next.
You know, hang together or hang separately. We have to do something about this. And the final ultimate absurdity is that what they do, what happens on the 9th of Thermidor, and particularly in the days afterwards, after Robespierre is safely dead, is that they will accuse him of being that thing that everyone else was accused of being. Robespierre will be publicly declared to have been intending to crown himself King of France and to marry the former king's daughter and to make peace with the crowned heads of Europe over the top of the bodies of the French. He will be declared to be the arch counter-revolutionary, and that will justify the extermination of him and all his friends. And then they will spend the next several months just figuring out how big a sigh of relief they can take, how dangerous things still are. The irony being that the military situation has now improved to the point where France is really dominant on the battlefield. By 1794 into 1795, the military threat has been crushed. But it also involved the crushing of this paranoid political leadership.
A bit of a digression, Professor. But going back to Robespierre, what was the cult of the supreme being that he was advocating for?
Right. Well, this, again, the whole religious question has continued to agitate the revolution. By late 1793... some people on the radical side have decided, you know, the logical answer to the fact that all these priests hate us is that we declare religion to be an abomination. That Catholicism in particular, but Christianity in general, revealed religion in general, is nonsense. It's the conscious articulation of oppressive myth to keep the people down. And there is quite a vigorous movement in late 1793, which is later called de-Christianization, didn't call itself that at the time, but these de-Christianizers really want to build an atheistic public culture. And this is where things like the invention of a Republican calendar come in these months. That you,
year one.
You move away from a calendar which is completely defined by a religious liturgy, that the 7-day week and the Sabbath and Lent and Advent and all these kind of things. You found a calendar in nature. So you come up with lots of sort of, you know, very vague allusions to the weather and the cycle of the harvest and so on. And you design a whole calendar around that. And instead of the 7-day week, you have a 10-day week, you know, which is a very middle class thing to think, because it means workers have to work 9 days before they get a day off instead of only 6. They never really figure out what they've done there. But the end of 1793 sees this real drive towards actual atheism as state policy. But Robespierre, as a follower of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, is very much more attracted to the idea of natural religion, of deism, of the idea that you can separate all the churchy stuff from the basic fact of there being a benevolent deity. And he and other slightly more moderate people are also conscious that the over-atheism thing is really, really never going to wash with the peasantry, with the majority of the population. You can't make France atheist overnight. So they will come up with, in the spring of 1794, the cult of the supreme being, which is really a sort of compromise measure. You know, it's intriguingly kind of moderate, given everything else that's happening around. But to allow people the idea of public worship, to allow people the idea of the supernatural, and to recognize the immortality of the soul, as the decree puts it, and then to try and turn that into a kind of civic religion that celebrates all kinds of, you know, nice values. They're festivals of youth, festivals of old age, festivals of being good to your parents, festivals of all kinds of virtues. So it's to sort of try to restore the idea of a kind of religious festivity to culture. Robespierre is really, really keen on this, but it is one of the points at which other people start to worry about him being a bit strange. That the more atheistic of his colleagues are all sort of exchanging sarcastic comments about him, because he's the current chairman of the National Convention. It's like a 2-week rotating chair. And he happens to be in the chair for these ceremonies, which means he gets to march in front of the procession and make the big speeches and so on when they inaugurate this cult. And there are people there in the background basically laughing at him and saying, oh, look, he's made himself Pope now. So from a political point of view, it goes very badly for Robespierre's image with his colleagues. It actually turns out to be quite popular in the country at large.
Interesting.
Precisely because it's seen as a rejection of atheism. It's seen by a majority of people as a turning back towards a religious attitude that they regard as more normal and natural. And it will continue on after the fall of Robespierre. It will continue on in various forms until the end of the 1790s, and until Napoleon restores the power of the Catholic Church.
It's so fascinating. I wonder if you can pinpoint with Robespierre where exactly does he turn from this, radical revolutionary advocating for a more universal enfranchisement. Mm. And I also read that he was against slavery. He was opposing the war and so forth. Where does he turn into this, like you said, priest ahead of the killing machine? Does he realize that that's happening, or is he just carried away in a sense?
Yeah, I think it's really a process which happens in the second half of 1793. He's always been someone who's understood himself as having a special relationship with the ordinary people. He's got this kind of idea that he's got his
own man of the people,
personal metaphysical connection with them. I mean, he's not a man of the people in any other sense. He's a very kind of prissy, refined, delicate individual.
Oh, really?
He's not a drinker. He's not a man who likes laughing and joking. Danton, in that respect, is much more a man of the people in that sense. You know, he's a man who could have had a whole tavern in stitches, whereas Robespierre would have been hiding in the corner drinking lemon juice.
A bit of an introvert.
Very much an introvert, except when he has the opportunity to make very long speeches, which he also likes doing. But in 1793, this is the process that they've gone through. You know, after the war has been expanded, after these initial measures of the terror have been brought in, there is just so much continued betrayal. Those Brissotins, those Girondins, those moderate Jacobins, or, you know, what are now moderate Jacobins, They are mixed up in conflict with the ultra radicals. They end up getting purged from the convention, and they don't sit back and take that. Their confederates in places like Lyon and Bordeaux and Marseille, they start fighting against the central authorities. The Girondin leadership flee to Normandy, towards Bordeaux. They stoke up literally a second civil war on top of the other one that's already raging in the Vendée. And that will take another huge mobilization. That will take the siege of Lyon, a siege of Marseille, the reconquest of Toulon, where they've actually tried to surrender the French fleet to the British. The 1793 sees really tremendous acts of treason carried out by people who were Republican leaders, and tremendous acts of treason which are punished brutally with military suppression, with trials in front of the Revolutionary Tribunal in Paris, the execution of all these Brissotin leaders who go to the guillotine absolutely unrepentant, singing the Marseillaise. That sense that if they can be traitors, if they can behave like that,
anybody can be. Right.
And Robespierre's, his belief in purity, his belief in that people should be like him, they should be completely selfless, they should be dedicated to the people. When people start coming to him in late 1793 and saying, look, here's some evidence, actual evidence that other people in these ruling committees are corrupt. There's a huge financial scandal that sort of bubbles below the surface throughout these months, that there is real corruption there. And, you know, he's seen as someone to whom this can be confided. But then he's also mixed up in these attempts to suppress ideological opposition, to make people like his friend Camille Desmoulins stop publishing inflammatory things. And Camille will not stop publishing inflammatory things. So Camille will end up getting mixed up with Danton after they've got rid of the ultra-radicals and they get rid of the moderates. They will get rid of Camille, they will get rid of Danton. They will execute Camille's wife on trumped-up charges of being involved in some kind of conspiracy. Yeah. Robespierre is plunging into this. You know, and you can wonder whether, to a certain extent, he has become sort of morally lost. You know, he has lost his way, that there is only forward, there is only assuming that everyone with initiative is bad, is capable of being bad. There is only that kind of paranoid attention. But that is the road he pursues. You know, he has become, by the last 3 or 4 months of his life, dangerous to other people, because he will accuse anyone of anything if he thinks it explains why everything's not going perfectly. Biographers will argue forever about to what extent his mental state is compromised, to what extent he's lost touch with reality. But his attitudes are also shaping reality. A lot of other people are going along with this, until the moment where it looks like the laser beam, the eye of Sauron, has turned on them. And at that point, finally, enough of them can get together to get rid of him. And then it turns out that nobody was his friend. He is the scapegoat for everything, because, of course, he doesn't do everything. He wasn't responsible for the tens of thousands of people that were killed in Lyon or Marseille or anywhere else. He wasn't responsible for any of the corruption that went on. He's against all of that. You know, he thinks people should have pure motives. But he becomes a corrupt monster because it's useful for him to be one. And a lot of what's gone on ever since has been people deciding whether to either excavate him from under that pile of abuse or just pile more stuff on top of him. So he remains essentially divisive.
Oh, what a fascinating story. All right. I'm sorry, I've taken up almost an hour and a half of your time. We slowly got to wrap up. We've come to the end of the terror. How do things stabilize? How does everything calm down? Why are not these people who just went through these events constantly looking over their shoulders if things are going to pick up again in this sort of a manner? How is the reign of terror coming to an end, basically?
Well, the scapegoating of Robespierre
serves
these very useful purposes.
Right.
It enables people to find something they can agree on. which means they don't have to look at their own behavior too closely. But that will remain fragile. Over the next year or so, there is a process whereby the very many people who've been detained as suspects, probably in one way or another, over 500,000 people who've been treated as suspects are let back into public life. People who've been expelled from the convention are let back into the convention. A lot of the Girondins' friends come back in. Different forces have different attitudes to forgiveness and vengeance. And then this is very problematic over time. And there will end up being quite a lot of vengeance, but it's sporadic. It tends to focus on relatively small numbers of leaders who can be accused of very clear crimes and tried and executed. The sense that they all have that there is a threat from below, that the radical crowd is still dangerous. This is reinforced by uprisings in Paris in the spring of 1795. And an elite consensus that that needs to be rigorously repressed is again something that binds the political class together. France has been fundamentally destabilized, and they will attempt to have a new constitution in the middle of 1795, where just to bring that into operation, they have to use the services of General Bonaparte to defend them against a royalist coup in Paris. That constitution is a model of checks and balances, bicameral legislature, the directory, which is like a sort of five-man presidency overseeing the government. So, your power is radically decentralized. But every time over the rest of the decade, in 97, 98, 99, when they're supposed to have free elections to those legislatures, the executive will change the result of those elections. There will be an administrative coup. People will be barred from office. People will be stripped of office. Electoral results will be overturned, because the people at the center are just too afraid of actually giving any initiative to this radically divided country. And from the other end of the political telescope, again, the history of the later 1790s in many localities is one of ongoing vendetta, where the injuries and the insults which emerged during the period of the terror are layered on top, in some cases, of decades old local feuds. In some cases are brand new local feuds, where law and order really is in very short supply right through to the end of the decade, where it starts to be more militarized, and that the army, the idea of military justice, starts to be seen as something more neutral, more beneficial to everyone in society who's got something to lose. And this is the road which takes France down to eventually deciding they just need to get rid of the politicians. They need strong men. And initially, some of the politicians think they can have a strong man and use him as a puppet, but they're wrong. And they will get Napoleon, and Napoleon will impose order. And frankly, after a whole decade of revolutionary upheaval, most people are really quite glad of that. That whatever the revolution achieved, it has disintegrated to such a point by the later 1790s that the authoritarianism is very much welcomed by the population at large.
With a twist of ultimate irony, at the end of it all, we don't get a king, but an emperor. Not immediately, of course, absolutely, but eventually.
And then a few kings back again afterwards.
Right, the Bourbon restoration, right.
It takes a long time to decide that the revolution was genuinely revolutionary, that you can't just turn the clock back.
Right.
That's really a perspective from a generation after that.
A while back, I interviewed historian of the Napoleonic period, Michael Rove from King's College London. And he said that he believes Napoleon was great, because I asked him, was Napoleon great or was he not great? And he said he was great, primarily because he was an institution builder. How much is this aspect of his legacy owed to the revolution?
Most of it. And again, I think this is where one will always wrestle with these relative issues. I mean, Napoleon for me is a very bad man.
Interesting.
His personal attitude to other people was sociopathic and megalomaniac. And I think there is ample evidence for that. Yeah. But one of the things he gives to France is the ability to refocus on what the revolution should have been able to achieve in terms of institutions, in terms of the codification of law, for example, which was a process that had started in 1790. You know, they're not doing anything from scratch in the 1800s.
Yeah.
They're picking up a decade of work, the consolidation of uniform local administration, of justice, of commercial codes, making peace with the church, whatever you think about that as a compromise. All these were things that needed to be done in order for France to have any kind of peace with the heritage of the revolution. Of course, a lot of the institutions Napoleon builds are essentially authoritarian, much more so even than the revolutionary ones. That election under Napoleon becomes offering him a short list of suggested candidates for a post, and he gets to pick. You know, it's absolutely reversing the logic of what election is in any meaningful sense. And of course, what Napoleon will eventually do is very nearly break France completely through the demands of his war making. And you know, people will again argue until forever about who's really to blame for all these wars. But you always come back that Napoleon never tried very hard not to go to war with anyone. He was very much of the mind that war was usually a good answer. And that will in the end throw France back into the arms of both of Louis XVI's brothers. They both get a crack at the throne after Napoleon. And one of the reasons for that is just because Napoleon has always been seen as this destabilizing influence. That the powers of Europe never wanted to make peace with him durably, because they never really trusted him to make a durable peace. And so the whole Napoleonic legacy will be thrown over, and you go back to the Bourbons for another generation. And you know, that takes us into the 19th century and upheaval after upheaval.
A broad question at the end. Is it necessary for these kind of momentous events of massive social and political change, or more specifically, revolutions, to always be accompanied by a lot of bloodshed? You mentioned the American Revolution as well, that it was proportionally similar to the French Revolution in that regard.
Well, I mean, that is one of those questions where you look at the historical record and you ask yourself, how do these things happen? How do countries get new constitutions? How does change happen over time? And it's one of those situations where, yeah, post-1945 Western Europe is a kind of bubble where the immense scale of the horror and suffering that had gone on for various reasons in the first 45 years of the century, you know, bracket that off. And you have to bracket off other things like decolonization, which is an extremely violent process as well. And if you bracket all that off, you can make kind of, you know, the slow evolution of the European Union, et cetera, look like a kind of normative process, like the kind of thing that ought to happen all the time. And maybe it ought to happen all the time. But the thing with history seen more broadly is it doesn't. Never happened like that before. And we're dangerously close to it never happening like that again. Thinking about France in particular, applying that question there, what you're looking at, again, going back to 1787, 1788, you're looking at collapse. Yeah. What had happened in France by July and August 1789 was that state authority, all the things that make the everyday relationships between people, property, the legal system, the justice system, each other, neighbouring communities, all those things had collapsed. They'd collapsed into something which for a lot of people felt horribly and dangerously like a state of nature, where taking up arms was the only option. And everything that happens in the revolution is, one way or another, an attempt to remedy that collapse. Now, what you think about that is very much dependent on your own personal ideological politics. I mean, the Ancien Régime monarchy was a hideously exploitative society. It oppressed the majority of its population overtly and shamelessly, it was better off gone. But practically speaking, getting rid of it brought horrors. And how far you accept that as worth the price is a fundamental political question that each person has to adjudicate for themselves.
And what do you think?
What do I think? It's not a question that you can simply resolve, you know, because these things are not simply, in my mind, worth it or not worth it. They are what happened, you know, and what we're looking at in history, what I try to look at in history is to understand the extreme complexity of what happens when systems break, when people try to change things, the extent to which unintended consequences almost always overwhelm initial intentions. These are realities. You know, it doesn't make, sticking with what you've got necessarily the best answer, because that could lead itself to catastrophe. You know, that can lead to a worse collapse down the line. Collapse is not necessarily avoidable. But I do, you know, regularly come back to the point that, you know, within any given society, we should always be very careful to try to preserve things like the bases of democratic freedom, because those things break in so many different ways. They were so difficult to establish in the first place. They required historically so much bloodshed that to think about throwing them away is a suicidal act for a society. And, you know, I'm deeply, deeply disturbed as we look around the world to see how trivially people treat the right not to just have arbitrary things done to them. People are far too happy with thinking about giving up that right for themselves, as long as they think someone they don't like will have some bad things done to them. And that is a recipe for disaster. And that is the recipe we are increasingly cooking up around us these days.
Ultimately, we always come down to this question or sentence: you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, right? But then...
Indeed not. But then if you pour the eggs into the fire and end up eating the ashes, what have you really gained?
All right, Professor, the very first question I asked you was, if the French Revolution was indeed the most important event in European history, like one of my university professors once claimed, you assured me that things were a little bit more complicated than that. So at the end, let me try again with an even sneakier question. Please forgive me. If the French Revolution didn't happen, what would Europe and indeed the world look like today?
It's a fundamentally unanswerable point, because one of the things the French Revolution gives us through its own evolution, through what happens later under Napoleon and into the 1830s, it gives us the ideological spectrum through which we understand the world today. It gives us the concepts of left and right at a very trivial level, but it also literally gives us the ideologies of liberalism, conservatism, modern aggressive nationalism, and indeed socialism, all in their own ways, are absolutely dependent on the conditions created by the French Revolution in order to be evolved into existence. A concept like conservatism didn't need to exist before the French Revolution, because the notion that you needed a political ideology to justify only slightly changing things was meaningless. You know, revolutionary upheaval on the order that France brought about was not understood as possible, except in the kind of sort of the history of the Reformation, for example, kind of religious ideological fanaticism. The idea that you could have secular ideological fanaticism and needed to do something about it was what the French Revolution put on to the world stage. The idea that revolution itself was a thing, and that you could orchestrate a revolution or conspire towards a revolution and bring about material change. The whole 19th century history of Europe is shaped by the attempt to revolutionize. whether it's in the name of a different social class, whether it's the name of different nations, whether it's in the name of other forms of liberation. Without what the French Revolution gave us, we wouldn't have a vocabulary to describe all of that. The people who did it wouldn't have had a vocabulary to do it with. So, you know, you imagine a kind of alternate history in which none of this happens, and that people end up trying to describe completely different quasi-continuity with the world of the 18th century, you know, and you're spiraling off into science fiction very quickly. You know, is the French Revolution, which told people how to think about these things, it told Hegel how to think about the world spirit, it told Marx how to turn Hegel on its head and talk about class, and then it told everybody else how to not do that, how to think in other ways. Everything is a bouncing back and forth off of that heritage of what people saw happen in France in 1789 and afterwards.
All right, so this statement from my professor, which seemed completely ridiculous at the beginning, now in light of your answer, doesn't seem so crazy at all.
Well, if there is a modern history, if there is a history of modernity, then the French Revolution is squatting there at the origin point, and you cannot go round it without very large detours.
Professor Anders, thank you so much. This was an incredibly illuminating conversation. Absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking the time for the second time. Again, for everybody who wasn't listening to the first episode, where can people find you on social media?
I have a Twitter account still. I'm Prof. Dave Andress on there, fairly actively.
And where can people find your book, The Terror? Find bookstores everywhere?
I imagine so. I mean, that it's right. 20 years old now, so probably some secondhand bookshops as well.
Fantastic. Again, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to Smart Cookies on YouTube. What else is there? Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you really like what you heard, feel free to become my Patreon. No, my patron on Patreon by going to Patreon and becoming my patron. It's really easy. Just type Smart Cookies Podcast in there. You should be able to find me. Last but not least, I have to thank the absolute legends that are my producers on this show, my existing patrons on Patreon: Aida, Mancian, Micha Medved, Medinho, Gordon, Jurečuk, Lorenzo, Mila, Carmen, Taichi, Goran, and Veronica. Without you guys, this show wouldn't exist. So massive thanks. And yeah, see you in the next episode. Bye.